Donald Trump lashes out at Germany over trade policy and declares that this longtime American ally needs to pay more for its own defense. The German chancellor now says that Europeans must take their fate into their own hands. Where does this leave the transatlantic alliance? We discuss with Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert. Back in Wisconsin, a deeply divided state Democratic Party meets this weekend to choose a leader and to pick up the pieces from last year's disaster of an election. Jason Stein has a preview. And in the city of Milwaukee, a multi-million dollar settlement 3 years after the tragic death of Dontre Hamilton. All that and more today from the best political team in Wisconsin on Politics. I'm David Haynes. I'm the opinions editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome to On Politics. Well, Donald Trump and Angela Merkel do not have quite the same kind of relationship that she had with Barack Obama. That was evident at the NATO summit and this week in a couple of the tweets that President Trump made. We talked to Craig Gilbert about that and what it might mean for the transatlantic alliance. Well, Craig, I know that you have friends in Germany, as do I. In fact, I was just over there for a week, and all anyone wanted to talk about was the German-American alliance. There's a lot of worry in Europe generally, in Germany in particular, given what Donald Trump has said in recent days. What do you make of this sort of back and forth between him and Merkel, and what's the state of that alliance?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think a lot of Americans appreciate just how deeply invested Germans are in the transatlantic relationship and in sort of the transatlantic order that we've had since the Second World War. And there's a lot of consternation, a lot of alarm, a lot of anxiety. I mean, it was certainly sparked by Trump's election because of their perceptions of Trump, but also it has only grown since then. I think it was exacerbated by the president's recent trip to Europe. Some people were freaked out that he didn't enunciate explicitly a recommitment to the defense of NATO nations, a clause in the NATO treaty. His body language, other comments and tweets about Germany's contribution and other European countries' contribution to NATO defense, and also their trade surpluses with the U.S., it all adds up to a lot of fear, a lot of suspicion, and kind of a hand-wringing about sort of where this leaves Europe and how they cope going forward with their most important ally if they do not, as Angela Merkel, the chancellor, alluded to the other day, if they start to see the U.S. as no longer a, quote, reliable partner.
Yeah, I mean, she said something to the effect, we have to take our fate into our own hands. Now, afterwards, Sean Spicer and others in the White House, and even the German ambassador to the U.S., were sort of papering this over, saying, well, you know, we still have a strong relationship. But this kind of language between allies is, that's a different kind of language, isn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, again, part of it, obviously, Merkel had a really close relationship with Obama. It wasn't that way at the beginning of Obama's tenure, but they grew very close. They're obviously much closer temperamentally than Trump and Merkel are. So there's a lot that goes into this. And she's even gotten some criticism in Europe. Some people thought that she overreacted, and they're afraid of sort of turning this into a self-fulfilling prophecy if Germany recoils, you know, so dramatically from Trump. But again, I mean, the relationship, it's not good. And the question is going forward, whether events are going to make it even worse. You've got, obviously, issues having to do with trade. You've got the controversy over the climate pact, and we're about to find out the final decision that the president has made about the Paris Climate Agreement. There's a lot of fear among other countries about how the U.S. is going to handle that. And then the ultimate question is whether this is isolating us on the world stage.
Right. And on the climate pact for a moment, that decision is coming out later today. There's a lot of speculation that the U.S. is going to pull out of the agreement. But I wonder what that says about the politics internally at the White House. There apparently has been a lot of discussion, a lot of disagreement. Ivanka Trump apparently favors staying in. Steve Bannon doesn't, for example. What will that say? What will his decision say about the current politics within the White House?
Well, you know, it may tell us something about the politics of the moment, but I don't know how much we can read into it, because the president has sided with, you know, one faction in the White House on some issues and other factions on other issues. Clearly, there are people in the White House who fear the sort of diplomatic repercussions of dropping out of the climate pact. Obviously, Secretary of State Tillerson is one of them. So there's, you know, there's a set of environmental concerns, but there's also a set of diplomatic concerns, the kinds that we've been talking about, and what this does, again, to the ability of the U.S. to sort of persuade its allies and partners to go along with our agenda when we need them. And I think that's those are the kinds of fears that were have been expressed by some people within the White House. But whatever the president does on climate, on the climate agreement, may not tell us how he's going to handle the next issue. In fact, he just already today announced that he was not going forward, at least yet, with a plan to move the U.S. embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, which is a case of a you know, not sticking with his campaign rhetoric, at least for now. So we've seen examples on both sides. I don't think we can have a lot of confidence based on just the decision on the Paris climate agreement alone about how President Trump's going to handle these kinds of issues in the future.
So let's talk about the White House staff. There was what could be the beginning of a shakeup this week with one of the communications people leaving. There's still a lot of speculation about Reince Priebus, former RNC chair from Kenosha, chief of staff. What's going on there?
So I think the speculation about Reince's future is the product of several things. One, just you know, all the turmoil at the White House. Two, you know, Trump's personality and leadership style. Three, the fact that, you know, Reince Priebus, you know, didn't, you know, come into this job based on a longstanding personal relationship with Trump. So he's vulnerable in that regard. Four, there's divisions and factions within the White House, as we've discussed. And five, there's a sense that, you know, it's inevitable that sooner or later, there's going to be a lot of shakeup, and that some people will be blamed and lose their jobs. And finally, the White House chief of staff is a brutal job, and in a White House beset by turmoil, it's sort of an obvious job on the firing line.
All right, Craig Gilbert in Washington. Thanks so much.
Great.
Well, the state Democrats get together in Madison this weekend to plot out their future. And we talked to Jason Stein of our Madison Bureau about what's up. So, Jason, the state Democratic Party is meeting in Madison this weekend. And after some turmoil following the election, what do the Dems need to accomplish this weekend?
Well, what they need to accomplish more than anything is get a series of candidates and a message that can resonate outside of Madison. So they're certainly going to be on very friendly and comfortable territory here this weekend, but they're going to need to find people and messages that reach out beyond Dane County and to some of the rural areas where Donald Trump outperformed Hillary Clinton in November.
And you talked about finding candidates. They still really need to identify a candidate to run against Governor Walker next year.
That would be a good candidate to have.
That'd be a good start.
There are two marquee statewide contests in 2018. The one, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, is running for re-election, so that's good. Check marks on U.S. Senate. But on the race for governor, which is such an important race for the future of the state, the Democrats have not really yet fielded a credible candidate, and that is they have some people that are kicking the tires on it. You know, State Representative Dana Walks, Andy Gronick, a Milwaukee businessman. But they, you know, they need to seal the deal and probably need to have, you know, various options, more than one option for their voters to consider.
So reasonably speaking, what's the time frame to stand up a candidate to run against an incumbent governor?
Oh, you know, that's a great question, David. I mean, you know, Scott Walker, our current governor, really ran in 2006, dropped out of that race, and started running a shadow campaign for governor almost immediately after the person that beat him in the GOP primary, Mark Green, lost to then Governor Jim Doyle. I mean, you know, he really ran for governor almost for 4 or 5 years continuously, depending on how you look at it. But, you know, certainly you need more than a year to put together a credible campaign for governor. And some of it depends on how much money you have of your own and how much you have to go out and raise from donors.
Mm-hmm. So we also have a race for state Democratic chair. Martha Laning, the incumbent, is running. Brian Kennedy is another of the candidates. Where does that look to be headed at this point? Are there any early indications?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I mean, you know, I think to a certain extent, Laning's decision to run again suggests that she feels like that she can get together the votes to hold on to another term. You know, at the same time, however, while she's been Democratic Party chairwoman, it's not been a good period for Democrats in the state of Wisconsin. And certainly, you know, in November, you have Donald Trump and Ron Johnson, who were, you know, candidates for U.S. Senate and president that many people saw as very beatable candidates, win their elections. And so obviously, you know, there are people within her party that are very unhappy about those outcomes and see, you know, her as at least, you know, having a hand in them or certainly failing to lead to a better outcome.
Yeah. And you talked about the messaging. Is there any developing consensus within the state party about what that messaging ought to be? There's a lot of talk about should they reach out more to the white working class voters that Donald Trump did so well with. Any consensus developing yet on that?
Well, they do have some enthusiasm. Right now it looks like they have double the registrations that they did, you know, in a very sort of off year in politics where nothing is happening, have many more registrations than they did last year in a presidential year. So they have enthusiasm. You know, a lot of that enthusiasm is around Democrats coalesces around opposing Donald Trump. You know, at the same time, there are also a number of sort of pocketbook issues that are out there that Democrats could rally around. And certainly one of them is the Republican plans to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a proposal that we've seen a shift from public opinion being against Obamacare to now seeing the current law as more attractive than the Republican replacement proposal. So that's another area where Democrats may choose to rally around, you know, in the coming months and years.
Well, Jason Stein in Madison, thanks so much.
Thank you, David.
I'm joined in our Milwaukee studio by Mary Spacuzza, reporter for the Journal Sentinel. Mary, thanks for being here.
Thanks.
And Dan Bice, a columnist for the Journal Sentinel. We're going to talk next about the settlement that the city has reached in the shooting of Dontre Hamilton 3 years ago by a Milwaukee police officer. Is this sort of the end of the story or the beginning of another one?
I would say not the end, the beginning of another chapter. The Hamilton family said that they plan to continue pushing for change. Maria Hamilton's been very vocal since the shooting, as have his brothers. So basically yesterday the Common Council approved a $2.3 million settlement. Almost everyone voted in favor of it. Bob Donovan, who was critical of it, abstained, and Terry Witkowski left the room and was absent. But it was interesting because Donovan, it seemed like he was not planning to speak and then decided that he had to speak and talked about how he slammed Chief Flynn for firing the officer who shot and killed Dontre Hamilton. He slammed the lawyers representing the Hamilton family who apparently are getting about $1.1 million. They pointed out this was 3 years of bitter litigation. But it brought a real flurry of responses, especially from a lot of the African-American alders who, multiple times said Black Lives Matter. This could have been one of our children. This could have been anybody's children. So the settlement, though, it doesn't go to the Hamilton family. There was a little bit of confusion over that. It actually goes into a trust for his young son. They did not give a specific age to try to protect his privacy, and he was only identified by his initials in the lawsuit. Mm-hmm. But essentially the idea is that his father's not going to be around, and they are going to use the money to provide for him. So the Hamilton family was a bit touchy about people apparently asking them, what are you going to do with all that money, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they said, this isn't about the money. This isn't the justice we wanted. They actually wanted a criminal prosecution for the officer, and it sounds like they're actually still hoping for that, although I don't know that that is in the future. But they basically said that he was rightfully fired, but they feel like he should face criminal prosecution as well.
We should just remind viewers, too, that this all was happening sort of in the context of the Black Lives Matter movement. Ferguson happened around that time mm-hmm. as well. There's been a lot of discussion both here and elsewhere around the country on police shootings.
Yes, and this was, this got national attention. The Hamiltons have been very outspoken. Maria Hamilton did multiple appearances mm-hmm. with Hillary Clinton during the last year's campaign and also met with her numerous times.
Does the settlement preclude any other legal action on the part of the family?
I think that they obviously wanted criminal charges. They didn't get it. I think that they are still hoping that maybe more evidence will come forward where they could actually try to push the DA to reopen the case or some kind of federal mm-hmm. charges. But I think they would, at this point, someone would have to come forward with new information or some new information would be revealed that would reopen the criminal case.
But no civil?
I don't believe so. I don't think there are plans for that at this time. They said this isn't a victory for us. We're not happy. We're not getting our son and our brother back. But it seemed to close this litigation chapter.
The officer was fired not for killing him, but for not following procedures, I remember.
Yeah, it was basically
sort of a technical issue.
What happened was other officers had gone to the park to check on him. He was sleeping. He wasn't breaking the law. Officer Manny didn't know that when he apparently got a voicemail saying to check on this person in the park, and he did a pat down, which Chief Flynn said was out of procedure. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Bob Donovan disputed that fact too, but that was the reason he was fired.
Okay. Thanks, Mary.
Thanks.
Well, let's go next to our winners and losers for the week, and I'm going to start, Mary, again with you. Who's
okay.
your winner?
I'm going to go with Brad Schimmel, our Wisconsin Attorney General. There's been a large sweep this week where he targeted, I think it was over a dozen, I want to say 16, sex offenders, people engaged in sex trafficking, child porn, basically people that you really don't want on the streets with access to young children. So I think anytime you can arrest a large group of people involved in that kind of thing is a benefit for Wisconsin and a win for him.
Okay, winner Brad Schimmel. Who's your loser?
Kathy Griffin.
Obvious.
Yes, yeah, I don't know. I don't know that anybody thinks she's a winner. Obviously, she decided to do this photo shoot posing with a severed head of President Donald Trump. Did not go over well. She was fired. She has apologized in a video apology. Which it does not seem like the president or his family have accepted. But generally, I just don't know who would think that was a good idea and why nobody would step in. And
pretty roundly condemned.
Well, she actually expected reaction.
She expected reaction. I don't know that she expected to be fired and expected to get such negative. Well,
but she knew what she was doing.
So you think she wanted to get fired? Or?
No, I think she knew that it was going to be provocative. It was intentionally provocative. Yeah. And they joked about the response. So mm-hmm. I think that was...
And she followed up with a tweet immediately that says, this doesn't mean I condone violence,
right?
If you remember. So she obviously was thinking about it.
I don't know. I would think that you'd think it through more to not only what are the consequences for, the country and our political dialogue at this time, but I would think the consequences for her personally of, like, if I posed with a severed head of somebody, I would assume I would be fired. So I don't know why she wouldn't assume that. Not that I've thought about that, but, you know, generally you're not going to keep your job.
All right, Dan, who's your loser of the week?
It's a national NRA lobbyist named Scott Meyer who was testifying yesterday in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he directed some of his comments to Senator Lena Taylor, and he was saying that outside of the Emancipation Proclamation, that firearm ownership has been the great equalizer for the blacks.
The blacks.
The blacks, yeah, which did not go over. He did get Lena's attention, and he also ended up on the ABC Evening News and a number of other places for that comment. So a little off the mark with that shot.
Right, right. Okay, who's your winner?
The Wisconsin Magazine, which is done by the NR, done by the DNR. The governor wanted to kill it off and get rid of it, and the legislatures decided to cut it from 6 issues down to 4, but it still exists. So, and a number, it's almost 100 years now. I didn't realize that.
And doesn't it actually pay for itself? Like, it doesn't seem like it's really a drain on the budget.
You have 80,000 subscribers, which is a pretty large number of people.
Okay. So let's take a couple of questions, Dan. I'm going to give you the first one here. It comes from David. And no, it's not me. The question is, basically, why do newspapers use so many unnamed sources? In this case, I think he's writing about the current investigation into the White House. Watching CNN, if it's quoting the Washington Post or the New York Times, they're using a lot of unnamed sources. Why don't they make it a point to name all sources whenever possible?
It's frequently a hard thing to do because people, know that President Trump has a history and enjoys firing people. So if people on his staff end up making statements that he would not like, I think he would be quick to turn around and fire them. So people frequently talk about things that they're not authorized to talk about, but, like the meeting between Donald Trump and the Russian diplomats, several people thought it should get out there what was said during that meeting, but if any of those names were attached to that, that would have been, what would happen? They would be canned right away.
And we should point out our policy at this newspaper is to, whenever possible, use named sources. But if we're not going to use them, then I think typically an editor has to know who that source is. And there's some
and why. And, one thing that we did,
to be a reason.
We have changed in recent years is to add in, the reason that someone is not speaking on the record. But, in politics, it's a tough sport, and people can, if they end up saying something on the record that is not okay, then they can get in deep trouble.
Right.
Okay. Happens all the time.
All right, so Mary, here's one for you. Basically asking, why are we still talking so much about Jared Kushner?
Still?
I think what the viewer is saying is that there doesn't seem to be anything new here, and it keeps getting regurgitated over and over on cable news. So
okay.
Why are we talking so much?
It was a slow weekend.
Yeah, so I would say that, so Trump is on his first, he was on his first international trip as president, busy docket. Meanwhile, we're hearing all this new news about the Russia investigation and evidence that Jared Kushner, or apparently reports, not evidence, but that he went to Russians and said, like, can we establish a back channel?
Right.
So I would say that is, a close advisor to the president. That's his son-in-law, Ivanka Trump's husband. He's not just a kind of minor player in all of this. And I think before we had heard, Flynn and other people, but somebody who is that close to the president, I think that it does. It's certainly information that I think a lot of people are interested in hearing.
Look back to the month of May. It's like rapid fire every day, story, 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 story. And then we hit the weekend, and things really slowed down. Obviously, Trump had just gotten back from the trip. He did tweet a couple of times, even the, what was it, Confief?
Tweet. Oh, whatever
Confefe.
That word was.
Confefe, yeah.
Yeah. I think he tweeted it, left it up for a while, then deleted it, and then kind of joked about it, but said that it was intentional.
Right, but I think it was largely a long weekend, so that Jared Kushner story just kept on coming up again and again. So,
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. Thanks for joining us on this edition of On Politics. Thanks to Dan Weissmuir and Spicuzza, Jason Stein in Madison, and Craig Gilbert in Washington. For On Politics, I'm David Haynes. Thanks for joining us.